Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
It's always exciting for our department to recognize an outstanding faculty member with an endowed chair, and I'm grateful to the DeLuca family for making this possible. As the Chancellor has pointed out, the EC department ranked highly in the National Research Council rankings. And the reasons for this were, if you look at the details, were the productivity of the faculty and the impact of their publications. And one of the faculty that pushed us into this upper echelon is Mark Rodwell. Now, you have in your program some details about Mark's bio, and the Chancellor has highlighted some things, but I thought I'd mention a couple of things myself. One is he's faculty director of the nanofabrication facility, which serves up to 60 companies and two dozen groups in the region and on campus. Secondly, he is chair of the curriculum committee, undergraduate curriculum committee in the ECE department, and he's also a member of the lab support committee. And Mark does all these things and conducts his research while teaching a full teaching load of undergraduate and graduate courses. So it's my pleasure today to introduce Mark Rodwell.
So let me start by thanking first the DeLucas for their incredibly generous and thoughtful gift. What can I do other than to say I will do my best to maintain a strong undergraduate program in circuit design, which is something we've been struggling to build for the last 20 years. Also, I particularly want to thank my number two mentors, Herb Cromer and Art Gossard, who've been tremendous helpful. I also want to thank personally Steve Long, Larry Cauldron, John Bowers, Umesh Mishra, and my colleagues and collaborators at Teledyne with whom I have worked for the last 20 years. Thank you also to Henry for your tremendous efforts, above all in giving us some buildings that we are now in, which we were suffering from in the last 20 years of all being packed like rats into small cages. But I think that does us some good. The measure of institution is the work you do. So with that as the background, let's get to the beginning of the talk and let's get going. So I will talk today about transistors and integrated circuits from DC, as is known in the electronics business, an old expression, DC to daylight or DC into the far infrared. And I would like to acknowledge my many colleagues and collaborators, too many to read right now. Okay, so we'd like to build electronics from DC to frequencies that we could see, or at least into the infrared. So the overall question is, how high in frequency can we push electronics? And here's the usual color chart of the radio electromagnetic spectrum with microwaves from about 3 to 30 gigahertz, with millimeter waves from 30 to 300 gigahertz. Beyond that, we have the far infrared from 300 gigahertz to 3 terahertz, which is about a millimeter to a third of a millimeter in wavelength. Then the mid-infrared and the far-infrared, each one a 10-to-1 step in frequency range, and then we get to vibrations of the electromagnetic field that we can see with our eyes. Okay, so where are things? When I was in graduate school, the transistors were a little faster than this, but the time I was in graduate school, integrated circuits, the highest frequency in 84, was about 13 gigahertz, which I thought was incredible at the time. Well, between us, my collaborators, and our competitors, where are we today for integrated circuits? 650 gigahertz. That's a lot, okay? Where do I think we can be by the time I retire? I think we can be building circuits at 3 terahertz, which means that the transistors have got to be roughly three times faster than that. I think we can build integrated circuits that go entirely through the bottom decade of what we call the infrared. So starting to do electronics with what we would start to think of as approaching visible light. And the next generation can attack the mid-infrared. Okay. Well, what would we do with it? One, there's a tremendous range of frequency space available there. Remember, this is a logarithmic scale. So we can build radios with vast capacity, not only because there's a lot of frequency space available, but because wavelengths are short. So you can pack radios closely together and get multiple beams to send lots of radio signals. The wavelengths are short enough to make images, but long enough so to not scatter off dust. And so we can do imaging, whether we're in a military system, whether we're trying to land a plane or fly a helicopter in fog or in a sandstorm. We can support the electronics community, the optics community, by building electronics fast enough to keep up with those optical fibers and build optical fiber links that are carrying terabits per second of information so we can download all those movies at nights that we want to see. Okay. So what's happening is there's a so-called terahertz or infrared gap. In other words, electronics has been attacking from the spectrum from the low frequency range. Optics has been attacking the electromagnetic spectrum from the high frequency range, starting at visible light and moving down to lower frequencies. Well, they do separate things. Optics is really a powerful thing, but the complexity and sophistication and just the overall number of transistors, the number of things that you can do in very cheap products that fill your life in electronics is unsurpassed by any technology. So we're not going to stop when these two meet, but indeed we will continue to push electronics as far as we can because we can do sophisticated and valuable things with high-frequency signals rather than simply generate power. In addition, we want fast transistors not only because we want to work at high frequencies for these applications, but because a high-frequency transistor gives you more gain at lower frequencies. And as any decent analog designer knows, what you immediately do is you trade that high gain away to get precision in your circuits. So what else could we do with a 3 terahertz transistor, such as we hope to build in the next 2 to 3 years? We could build digital logic at a 500 gigahertz clock rate if you want to build really high-speed fiber optic links. In the range of a few tens of gigahertz where radar lives today, you can build precision analog-to-digital converters and the like for digitally processing with high sophistication those signals. And you can build precision analog circuit designs such as the DeLucas and Maxim Corporation are interested in, and do precision design and op-amps with the precision that you're used to at audio and low radio frequencies, but well into the microwave bands, analog design at microwave, and the precision and effectiveness of that. Well, where are we today? When we look in far infrared, today what we've got is great big far infrared lasers as big as a bathtub. More recently, the quantum cascade lasers that generate power with smaller devices, and things like hot electron bolometers to detect those signals. But what these things are doing is generating and detecting heat. They can get the phase of the signal with interferometry, but the device itself is just a power detector and a power generator. What we want to do, and I've gone and put it in my briefcase here, so it's terrible to lose this, is this thing is a cell phone. And the complexity of the signal processing within it is enormous. We want to do everything that that cell phone does, but to do so in infrared frequencies. So we want to take classic concepts of electron devices, classic concepts of circuit analog and digital circuit design, standard receiver, transceiver, block diagrams dating back to the 1920s, and build modern radio communications working in the infrared. In other words, let's do this stuff, but at frequencies high enough that you feel it with your hand as heat. Okay? You got it? So how do we do that? What is it all about? Well, it's all about interfaces and surfaces. Two little balls here, one called Jupiter, another called a golf ball. It's also about resistance, wire resistance, thermal resistance, heat, and it's about charge density. I won't read this to you in any great detail, but if you've been in a semiconductor class, you've seen these kinds of terms in your semiconductor physics course. Capacitances, transit delays, resistances, capacitances, thermal resistance. This is the wrong audience to go through these things, so I propose for this audience to do it a little bit differently. So let's talk about elephants. Okay? Let's talk about elephants, and let's talk about Galileo, but with due credit to a guy who did it a little bit better than Galileo a little later, J.B.S. Haldane. So when Galileo was around, there were these stories coming around the world of going to deepest, darkest, remote places and finding elephants that were bigger. 10 times taller, 10 times wider, 10 times deeper. And he said, well, no, that's not going to work because there's 1,000 times more flesh, yet there's only 100 times more skin area to lose the heat, so the elephant's going to get awfully hot. Okay? There's 1,000 times more flesh, so it weighs 1,000 times more, but its bones have only got 100 times the surface cross-sectional area, so its legs break. Okay? It's got 1,000 times more flesh, but the surface areas of the lungs are only 100 times larger, so it suffocates and dies. Okay? As I say, I mean, it's first from Galileo in 1638, but it's put in a more careful form that I'm quoting here from J.B.S. Haldane on being the right size. Great thing to read, okay? And there was a fellow a couple years ago who rewrote these equations just in a different physical format, and his name is Bob Dennard, and the paper is Design of Ion-Implanted MOSFETs with Small Physical Dimensions, which is what you know as scaling laws of MOSFETs. I've just done them for you with elephants. Okay, so there's one other thing to think about that I've left off this slide due to time, is if this guy goes out for a run and gets hot, he's got to cool down. This guy's 1,000 times bigger than that. He's got 1,000 times more heat to get rid of, but only 100 times the surface area. So he cools down more slowly. Okay, so small things, in small things, things happen faster. Big things, things happen slower. Okay? So let's apply that properly. Let's do it the other way. Let's take that elephant and let's make it 10,000 times smaller. But let's think about those issues of bone cross-section, lungs, lung area, those other issues. And let's scale that elephant properly following those laws rather than just shrinking it blindly. And following Dennard's scaling laws for elephants, that's what we get. Okay? That's a properly scaled elephant using Dennard's scaling laws. Okay. So in the interest of time, I won't go through that, but applying these principles to bipolar and field effect transistors, it tells us as we make it smaller and faster, how much do we have to shrink the dimension this way, how much that way? How much does the current per unit area go up? How much does the resistance per unit area of interfaces, how thick do dielectrics happen? What do we do about heat removal? Okay, but here's the take-home message. It's all about interfaces, of course. As we make an object smaller, the surface is shrinking less rapidly than the volume is. So as we make things smaller, the surface properties matter most and more. So in semiconductor devices, that's the interface. It's the metal semiconductor interface, otherwise known as the ohmic contact. It's the semiconductor dielectric interface, otherwise known as the gate dielectric. Those are the two number one battles in making ultra-small and ultra-fast electron devices. Of course, geometry and elephants and Haldane and Galileo tell you that. It's all about heat. As we push current through smaller devices, they're getting hotter and hotter. How do we correctly design the geometry of this device to control the temperature rise as I run the same amount of electrical power through a junction that's smaller and smaller? When we look at thermal resistance of a thin, narrow stripe, we see quickly that if we want to control the temperature rise and while shrinking the area, that it's a lot smarter to make it a long, thin stripe than to reduce it in proportionally in all dimensions at the same time. In one case, as the temperature rise will go as 1 over the linear dimensions. In the other case, it will go only logarithmically as the dimensions as we win. In a similar way, if we've got a circuit, we want to make the circuit faster. Speed of light hits us. We've got to make the wires shorter so the transistors are closer together, so the same amount of heat is packed in a smaller area. What happens to the same amount of heat being trying to be removed from a smaller area? We end up with temperature rises varying as 1 over the linear dimensions of the object. And hence, the temperature rise goes as in proportion to the speed of the circuit. So we've got to get more clever in heat removal. So it's all about geometry. This slide, I apologize for. I don't know the subject well enough to reduce it to the level of comedy. So I'll simply state the principle without, and this is because I'm only recently under Herb Kroemer's tutelage getting competent at quantum mechanics. But as we run more current through the transistor, as we make the transistor faster and faster, we need more and more current in a given area or volume. And quantum mechanics tells us that more current comes from more electrons, and we have to actually put those electrons in quantum states, or to a popular audience, chemical bonds. And we're running out of chemical bonds to put the electrons in. So we've got to do things with the design of the semiconductor itself to be able to pack more electrons per unit area or volume within a given energy range that we're working. And that's called the density of states challenge. And we're working hard on that. Okay, and working with the transistors, with the way we build them is a major battle. It's hard to build transistors that are very small. We need awesome contacts. We need super high currents. And the junctions are getting very skinny. So we've got junctions here that are carrying 10 million amps per square centimeter. And that junction, that contact, is only 100 atoms away from a junction which would be ruined if the metal were to diffuse in that amount. So we have to work very hard at contacts between the semiconductor and the metal that are low resistance and can withstand ferocious current densities without moving on an atomic scale. So these are the challenges. So looking at those rules of designing elephants and mice, we've mapped out over the years a plan called a scaling roadmap and how to shrink the transistor and make it faster. And the physics is easy, but building the transistors is enormously difficult. So there are teams of dedicated and phenomenally hardworking grad students working on building transistors that are very small, making super low resistance contacts, and using metals that can withstand the tens of millions of amps per square centimeter. We've got to run through these devices without the structure collapsing and getting the heat out as well. A recent result, and we're trying to do much better. This is from Vibor, Evan, Johan, Hanwei, a transistor where the power gain cutoff frequency is sitting at a terahertz right now. We find this, in fact, they find it enormously frustrating. They want it to be at 2 terahertz by the end of the summer. Along with my colleagues at Teledyne, for most of whom these recent results are due, where are we right now? Just a quick show. Transistor oscillators at 570 gigahertz. That's an infrared. Transistor amplifiers at well above 400 gigahertz. That's a transistor circuit in the infrared. Digital circuits running at 204 gigahertz. That's not quite in the infrared, but it's a more complicated thing. Soon it will be in the infrared. We'll be at 300 gigahertz. Complicated things like phase lock loops, again, touching on the infrared. Op amps, such as would be used at Maxim, but these op amps are 50 gigahertz bandwidth. Okay, that goes right through the microwave. More complicated things like amplifiers, mixed signal circuits, sample and holds used in A to Ds, and real things for processing real signals. Just a snapshot of how fast this has been going. We started building these transistors with our colleagues at Teledyne roughly in 98. First digital circuits at 30 gigahertz. Progression of the same basic design with improved circuit design, improved transistors, running up to 200 plus gigahertz last year. And with the transistors that they're building now, if they would just get off their butts and do it, 300 gigahertz would be possible. Where is it, Zach? Why aren't you doing it? Okay, well, what's next? These are the block diagrams. Again, same thing for generating, detecting the signal in this. What's next is to build a 2 terahertz transistor, to build the basic circuits just like in one of those, but then to build a radio at a terahertz, halfway in the infrared, supporting and proving that we can do those things. Classic sophomore level circuit design in the infrared. Okay. What and why for the second effort, 3.5 MOS, what is it? This is a second major effort and one that we are really excited about. And a major potential of this university and the efforts first founded here 20 years ago contribute to mainstream industry. We and others, colleagues and competitors around the world, are trying now to build the same MOSFETs that you find in all of these computers and cell phones, but now to build the channel material out of the compound semiconductors that Herb Kroemer and Art Gossett and his colleagues pioneered so long ago. Why do this? Well, if you do it right, which is a big if, there's a potential to get more current out of a transistor a given size and hence more speed at a given geometry of device. I'm showing you a device here built in our lab by Andy Carter. That's about a 50, 60 nanometer gate length. Is it easy? No. There are massive challenges in the materials and in the processes, producing high quality gate dielectrics, growing these materials on silicon, and learning how to adopt the crude processes that our community uses to the extreme sophistication and small size that the silicon industry uses. Okay, what do we need to do every time we shrink the transistor? We've got to get higher and higher levels of doping that are shallower and shallower. We've got to get thinner and thinner dielectrics. And I mentioned and alluded to that state density issue. Somehow we need to keep the electrons moving just as fast, but pack with each scaling generation twice the density of electrons in as we previously had. And that's some challenges there in the semiconductor physics level. To give you some ideas of the numbers here, if we're shooting for 9 nanometer gate length, and it's going to happen, guys, the equivalent thickness of the gate dielectric is going to be about 0.2 nanometers thick. These doped regions here need to be nearly at the solid solubility of how much doping you can get in, and yet they need to be only 3 nanometers wide, lest you get a leakage current down like that. 3 nanometers deep, what's that? Well, 2 nanometers is the distance between atoms, so you're saying I want it to be about 15 atoms deep. So these are the challenges. What are we doing? These are transistors from our labs. What we're working on is growth of the source and drain regions using the molecular beam epitaxy techniques developed here. Very heavily doped, extremely shallow. In modified form, they can probably produce layers in the channel with atomic layer definition, which is what we're going to need if we're going to push transistors below about 5-nanometer gate lengths. And we can maintain the transport advantages of the 3.5s, which is the electrons moving really fast. One of the biggest questions is how thin can we make those dielectrics? And we also need to work very hard, unless all of our efforts will fail, to get these structures grown on silicon. I just comment as a side point, since this talk has been about high frequencies, that these transistors at these dimensions, a nanometer FET, is very definitely a multi-terahertz FET. Okay, so this is my closing slide as I wrap up with my 20 minutes. And this is also my editorial comment. Where lies the future of electronics? You open up Scientific Magazine and you open up Discover Magazine and you hear something, and it's causing young people to leave electron devices as a field of research. And they're going into other disciplines, or they're going into alternative ways of doing electronics. Well, so the words you hear are, it's the end of the scaling roadmap. It's all going to be over soon. What we need to do is something different. No more Moore's Law. We need to do something more than Moore. That's the buzzword. Yet, for your consideration, first there were vacuum tubes. Later, there were bipolar transistors. Most recently, there are field effect transistors, now astronomically small. What comes next? As Herb has pointed out so many times, these are really all the same device. They're all got a sort of flood of electrons over here and a barrier that you're putting in the way that's controlling the current flow. This image is a little blurry, so I'll tell you what it is. It's a sluice gate, one of those things you move up and down in a channel to let water through. All transistors are the same. You're just putting an electrostatic barrier in the way of current flow. That's a dumb, stupid, old-fashioned idea. We need to get rid of it. That's what the magazine says. It's time for a new approach. Okay. Well, if we're going to do a new approach, we need a toolkit. And here's what nature gives you. Those are the particles of the standard model, right? That's all you have to work with. Who wants to do gravitonics? You're going to give up a factor of 10 to the 42nd, okay? In the force between two electrons, gravity versus electric fields. You want to do quarkonics? Pretty short range. How about neutrinoonics? Your gauge is going to be 3 light-years of lead. Okay? So that's kind of silly, but it gets us in the spirit. Let's be a little bit more serious. Mechanics, microelectromechanical systems. Now you're talking moving a piece of silicon. That's tens of thousands of silicon nuclei, each of which has hundreds of protons and neutrons in the nucleus, each of which weighs roughly 2,000 times another electron. That's a heavy thing you're moving. You're not going to do it fast, right? Okay? More recently, tremendous interest in magnetics. But the ratio of force between two objects goes as V squared over C squared for two charged particles between the electric and the magnetic fields. So unless those particles are moving darn close to the speed of light, magnetism loses. Okay? We are on a good road. We're on a good road that was started a century ago, but it remains a good road. Electrons are light. There are a few things lighter than this, but not things that interact strongly. Electrons interact strongly, the electrostatic forces are strong, and they're long range. That is unique in nature. That is the path we must take, and the only remaining question is how small we can make it. And that is my presentation. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.